Schopenhauer's works, the main work that he wrote is called The World as Will and Representation, and there are about six volumes of his writings, which is actually pretty minimal by the standard of many German philosophers. He's also distinctive, I think, because of the way he writes and the audiences he's tended to appeal to. In 1877, Wilhelm Wundt, who was a leading philosopher of the time, was trying to sum up German philosophy for an English audience. And he said, Schopenhauer is the born leader of non-academic philosophy in Germany. He notes how much Schopenhauer attacked the professorial philosophy of philosophy professors. So what he'd think of us, I don't know. Schopenhauer's declaration that it's unworthy to live by philosophy instead of for philosophy. And his rudeness towards many other philosophers of the day, all of these are features that people reading Schopenhauer today will note. Wundt, in this article, also attributes Schopenhauer's success with a non-academic readership partly to his brilliant writing style and his engaging literary personality. And if you read Schopenhauer, people, strangely, I think, given his message is rather a bleak one, people find themselves warming to a kind of unique literary voice. It's kind of didactic, mischievous, but also bluntly honest. But the chief reason for his popularity in the late 19th century was his pessimism. And as Wilhelm Wundt commented in his review, this pessimism has completely fallen in with the current of his time. So I want to start by saying just a word about what this pessimism is, why he became so influential for a period of time in the 19th century. Well, to begin with, Schopenhauer, early in the 19th century, had already, in effect, announced the death of God, in quotes. Famously, Nietzsche said that later. Nietzsche retrospectively commended Schopenhauer as the first admitted and uncompromising atheists among German philosophers. Schopenhauer doesn't argue against the existence of God, nor does Nietzsche. Rather, Schopenhauer, well, I think both of them actually, proceed on the assumption that by the beginning of the 19th century, the remnants of the old scholastic philosophy, which was really based around Christian metaphysics, have just lost credibility. And Schopenhauer ridicules contemporaries who try to build their philosophy around the idea of God or some notion of the absolute. Schopenhauer's own metaphysical system is, I think, thoroughly atheist, which is not to say that it doesn't have any connections with religion. I'll explain that later. He resolutely excludes any hint of a deity, any absolute being, any divine purpose. So the world lacks the meaning that Christianity traditionally assigned to it. And this is in, he's writing in 1819. Not long before that, it was absolutely impossible to present oneself as an atheist in the German world. So I think Nietzsche's right that he comes out, as it were, as an atheist quite early on in the history of the thing. So there's no God, no divine purpose. The world lacks the meaning Christianity traditionally assigned to it. And at that moment, as Nietzsche again put it later, Schopenhauer's question immediately comes at us in a terrifying way. Does existence have any meaning at all? And Schopenhauer pursues this question and constructs, I think, a challenge for the inquirer who wants to pursue that question with him. He asks us to face the truth, as he sees it, that ordinary human existence is by nature full of unresolved desire, suffering, and boredom, all of which has no point outside itself and leads inexorably to the individual's demise. He says, anyone who really understood the nature of human existence in advance, if you could do that, and who had the choice, would see it as, quote, a business that doesn't cover its costs and would prefer not to exist at all. It would have been better for us not to have existed, he quite literally says. So life is in need of some redemption, but there's no divine order or being or any kind of ultimate guarantee to provide it. That's the challenge that he poses. And I think that is very much of the age. The mid to late 19th century is when this crisis, if you like, started really hitting in thought and culture more generally. and maybe we've got more used to it now. Maybe we don't actually recognize the role of Schopenhauer, among others, in getting us to this state. The key, really, to this stark vision, as I'm presenting it, is his concept of will. And Schopenhauer sees each human individual as, in essence, a being that strives. It's probably the best word for it. Our essence is to strive. So rationality and even consciousness are secondary phenomena that characterize a human species, but there's a deeper essence we have which we share with the whole of nature. Other animals and even plants are, like us, hardwired, as we say now, to strive towards the perpetuation of their existence and the reproduction of their species. We are not in any way different, in essence, from the rest of nature. That is the key to his vision. And he says that we are, in essence, will to life, will towards life, Wille zum Leben in German. And this will to life blindly pursues its ends. The vast majority of human behavior is egoistic, willing, tracing back to the fundamental drives to survive and reproduce. And this is the thing, really, about Schopenhauer's view. It doesn't really matter how the individual life turns out. Whatever the particular goals and desires we form, all lives have the same structure. We will one thing or another, and for him it doesn't really matter what those things are. We will one thing or another and suffer from the absence of what we will. Then we attain it, but we don't, he says, we don't feel anything but the momentary sensation of the aching lack we felt before, and just find that a new desire rushes in, leaving us once again unsatisfied. So we keep on wanting, we get something, and then it doesn't stop us from wanting again. And there's this endless, unsatisfiable willing that he thinks defines the structure of all life, including human life. Too much satisfaction produces only the odious condition of having nothing particular to strive for. In other words, boredom. He's very good on boredom. There's no ultimate goal to all this willing. There's no point, purpose that we're finally going to reach. But there's also no action we can take to stop it. He's got interesting views about suicide, which he thinks is not a solution. Okay, we are different from the animals because we have, from other animals, because we have superior cognition. We can form concepts, have a sense of the past, a sense of the future. But that really only makes things worse for us because we can remember the past and conceptualize the future. It just makes us full of guilt and anxieties about satisfied or unsatisfied willing. And so we have more things to trouble us than the animals, who merely have unsatisfied desire of the moment. Well, Schopenhauer presents this scene of pointless misery, as I've described it. That's not all he says, but I mean, this is the core of the pessimism that we're starting from. He presents this in magisterial and uplifting tones, and it's a great read, I think. I mean, people have often said this. It's curious how somebody with this view of the world can be very fulfilling to read. He has very spiky humour at times, and I think he succeeds in developing a persona that draws us in to him. He's trying to be honest and puncture the pretensions of many other thinkers. He's very literary. He draws on lots of literary figures, Goethe, Petrarch, Dante, the Greeks. And tragedy is the art form that, you might not be surprised to hear, is the art form that best conveys the timeless human condition. There's a famous quote here. He uses these figures from Greek mythology as emblems for what human life is like. And so Tantalus, you know, Tantalus is ever striving to reach, I think it's the grapes and water that he needs to satisfy his thirst, and they recede as soon as he gets there. The Danaids are these, they're condemned always to pick up water in a leaky vessel, a sieve, and just endlessly try to satisfy themselves. So he says, as long as our consciousness is filled by our will, as long as we're given over to the pressure of wishes and their constant hopes and fears, as long as we're the subject of willing, we never have lasting happiness or peace. But without peace, there can be no true well-being. So the subject of willing, which is all of us, remains on the revolving wheel of Ixion, keeps drawing water from the sieve of the Danaids, and is the eternally yearning Tantalus, just one of these famous rhetorical attempts to sum up what human life is like. Well, so why should we be interested in Schopenhauer? I think there's two sides to Schopenhauer, really, that we perhaps need to distinguish. On the one hand, he's a metaphysician. He really is trying to give an account of what the whole world is in itself, in the sort of way that much earlier thinkers, say, like Spinoza or Leibniz in the 17th and 18th centuries were trying to do. But on the other hand, he can be seen, has been seen, as a kind of proto-existentialist. Theodore Adorno said that he was the peevish ancestor of existential philosophy, of particularly the 20th century, as well as being the heir to the great speculators such as Spinoza. So Schopenhauer sets out to have this grand unified vision of what the world is, but I think what's important to us as 21st century readers of him is the unsettling influence that his ideas have on various traditional notions. So Schopenhauer wants us to see that the existence of the world and of ourselves within it is problematic. The world is not good, and it'll never get better. We have no intrinsic human dignity. We'll never really achieve happiness, whatever efforts we make. So I think the metaphysics, which there are many technical problems with from a metaphysical point of view, philosophical point of view, is less important than the effect of Schopenhauer's views on certain traditional notions we have about the value of human life. I talk about Schopenhauer's legacy here a bit, and I think it's this sense of undermining of confidence in traditional values, a kind of anxiety that sets into thought in the 19th century, that for which he's rather important. He influenced Wagner very strongly. He was Wagner's favourite philosopher. There's lots of diary entries. Cosima Wagner writes in her diary, sort of many evenings we read Schopenhauer together. And it influenced Wagner greatly. And it really, in that whole period of the late 19th century, Schopenhauer was widely read and influenced many cultural figures, musicians, writers. For example, Thomas Mann, thoroughly imbued with the knowledge of Schopenhauer, and many others in that period. The two I would pick out, though, as people he influenced in some way or other, were Freud and Nietzsche. Freud famously said that he didn't really read Schopenhauer, so he didn't really have any direct influence from him. But he gave him credit for two massive anticipations of psychoanalytic theory. And this is a quote from Freud. Freud said, "Not only did he assert the dominance of the emotions and the supreme importance of sexuality, but he was even aware of the mechanism of repression." So it's the idea of there being an unconscious well of emotion and striving, particularly to do with sexuality, and the idea that the conscious mind can repress it, those are both there in Schopenhauer. So Schopenhauer's notion of the will to life that we mentioned is not just a will to survive, but a will to reproduce, a will to procreate. And Schopenhauer thinks that all our consciousness is actually beneath it. There's this drive to reproduction, and we're kind of deluded into thinking that the individual person we fall in love with is in some way special. It's all just some kind of trick. This blind drive to reproduce is what's really pushing us on underneath. He developed all these views quite early on in 1819, but they really are expressed most profoundly, I think, in the second edition of his main work in 1844. Quite a bit before Freud, and Freud says he never read it. Well, you know, you never know at what level he's in denial about that. He must have known about Schopenhauer fairly early on. There are clearly, if you like, waves of influence that Freud later picks up a couple of generations later. The real case of influence is on Nietzsche. Nietzsche obviously has been recognized in the 20th century as one of the most important modern thinkers, And I would maintain Nietzsche is almost unintelligible without an understanding of Schopenhauer. Because as we saw earlier, he says Schopenhauer raises this terrifying question, does existence have any meaning at all? Schopenhauer's the first honest atheist to try and face that question. And Nietzsche, even when he disagreed with Schopenhauer, which he did greatly towards the end of his life, still referred to Schopenhauer as his great teacher. So, you know, it's common to see Nietzsche as diagnosing a kind of crisis of nihilism, a crisis of there being no values in European culture. And I think he sees Schopenhauer as bringing that crisis to a head in his philosophy. But I think really what Nietzsche objected to was Schopenhauer's attempted solution to the crisis, a solution to the awful human condition as Schopenhauer saw it. Because what I haven't mentioned yet is the possible reasons to be cheerful. Because Schopenhauer paints this picture of human life and says it's inescapably like that, that the essence of human beings is to strive, the striving can never be satisfied, we suffer, all aspects of life really are a kind of suffering and we're deluded if we think otherwise. Yet he doesn't leave it at that. He thinks that there are ways in which this situation can be alleviated. And I suppose my view is that some of these are actually more terrifying than the crisis that he puts us in to start with. Well, more difficult in some ways. So, as we see here, under reasons to be cheerful, we can talk about art. Schopenhauer thinks art is extremely important. He has a view of what ethics is, what moral value is, which also counteracts to some extent the vision that he's given. And finally, has this notion of negation of the will to life, which I think is what really got Nietzsche going, which is really, really denying of the human condition, in effect, that provoked Nietzsche into seeking an affirmation of life, as he calls it, saying yes to life. So I'm not going to talk more about Nietzsche now because it would take too long. But let's just say a little bit about what Schopenhauer thinks about these so-called reasons to be cheerful, or reasons to be slightly less depressed, anyway. Schopenhauer's views on the value of art have been very influential, and he sees the experience, which is aesthetic experience, shall we say, as a form of disinterestedness. That means we're experiencing the object without engaging it with any of our desires or needs. We're just contemplating it passively. We're a passive mirror of the world. And we cease to sort of grapple with the world and want things from it. We're just mirroring what's there passively. And this is a release from striving and a release, therefore, from pain, from suffering. We're just registering the world without trying to get anything out of it, to put it absolutely crudely. And he thinks that this gives us a better insight into reality because our own will is temporarily suspended, so we see things more objectively. We see things closer to the way they are in themselves. And he is very knowledgeable about the arts and goes through all the different arts and what universals they enable us to understand. There's a very special view of music, which again was taken up by many musicians and thinkers. Music reveals the will itself, he says. The world expresses the will, and so does music. So he has ideas such as that in a musical melody or a harmonic progression, it's like the action of a willing being through time. The music sets out in a direction, as it were, strives through time from moment to moment to attain its goal. And long, slow pieces with very delayed resolutions in the harmony mirror the state of a being whose will is unfulfilled, sad, disappointed, whatever. Fast pieces with easy transitions between the notes are expressive of the form taken by fleeting happiness or joy. There's an attempt at the very, very hard philosophical question of how it is that music expresses emotion, to which there's still no very satisfactory answer, actually, surprisingly. In ethics, Schopenhauer makes the central virtue, really, that of compassion. feeling another's pain in a such a way that it motivates you to prevent it or alleviate it. And he says, really, that's the only thing that is of moral value, action stemming from compassion for other beings who are suffering or liable to suffer, is really the only locus of moral value, moral worth, as he also calls it, we can also call it. But what's important about this for him is that the moral person, the morally acting person, quote, makes less of a distinction than is usually made between himself and others, unquote. So the ordinary human condition outside of morality is to be egoistic, is to have everything centered upon one's own will. Ethics is a kind of breaking through the barriers of individuality to somehow see the other as, well, in a sort of inchoate way, not really distinct from oneself. It's this idea that somehow one, the normal egoistic action, which we're all full of, sees individuals as separate, but there's a kind of deeper truth, which is that really individuality is a kind of illusion. So morality rests on compassion, but compassion, why is compassion such a good thing? Because it actually gives us the right view, which is that we're not really properly, basically, distinct from the rest of reality. That's quite a hard doctrine to accept. But here we actually glimpse another really interesting distinguishing feature of Schopenhauer. I think well ahead of his time, he studies Indian philosophy, Vedanta philosophy, and also Buddhism later. And perhaps his favourite book was the Upanishads, which he acquired early and read throughout his life. And he really seeks to incorporate some of these insights about, to put it crudely, the illusoriness of individuality, and indeed the illusoriness of individual suffering, in a way, from Indian thought, or at least he sees a confluence between them. That's important, I think, in historical terms. As the first major Western thinker who really took Indian thought seriously. Well, finally, the extreme conclusion to the book, The World as Will and Representation, is where Schopenhauer advocates a kind of extinction of the natural self. And it's here that he starts to sound rather religious. He has an intense conviction that this is the way that life can be redeemed, and writes in, I think, incredibly powerful prose, which is impressive but also rather disquieting. So he talks about saintliness and conversion and redemption and grace. There's no God, there's no metaphysical divine being or purpose to the world, but still there can be an internal transformation that can happen to human individuals. And he calls that the will's self-negation or self-abolition, even. So in his view, Christianity and Hinduism and Buddhism all contain elements of this same wisdom, provided you just set aside completely all the dogmas and deities and all the metaphysical part. It's this idea of a transformation in consciousness that they all have. So the idea is that at an extreme point, something can stop the individual from willing on his or her own behalf at all. It's as if you become detached from the individual human being that you happen to be. Experience of the world, then, he says, would no longer motivate you to attain goals or flee from harm attached to this particular individual that you happen to be. You would attain an elevated state of passivity, in which the world would be seen as if from nowhere within it, and your individual character, your very person, as he calls it, would be extinguished. And he talks about this in very elevated terms as a kind of blissful emptiness, no striving and no suffering. And he says, well, from the standpoint of our own unaltered consciousness, this may seem a dreadful state of nothing or nothingness. But then, he adds, He imagines that once this transition has been made, the whole world as we ordinarily experience it would also dwindle in significance and be seen as nothing. So what he's advocating is a kind of extinction of our very nature, our very essence of striving for goals that attach to an individual being is the problem. If only we could stay alive, still have consciousness, but detach this consciousness from the individual entirely, then life is redeemed. He thinks that this will only happen to a very few individuals who he calls saints or saintly characters. He thinks it can also be brought about by an extremity of suffering that actually knocks out your identification with attaining the ends of a particular individual human being. But only this, he thinks, has true value. Only attaining that state, which is rare, would have true value. And just to go back to Nietzsche for a minute, this, I think, is what Nietzsche found so deeply troubling and abhorrent about this philosophy, is that the only answer is that your individuality is extinguished. Right? The only answer is that you cease to be natural, you cease to say yes to life, you become this kind of pure mirroring subject floating outside. And Nietzsche compares Schopenhauer with Buddhism in a very disparaging way. So I think if you want a little handle on what's motivating Nietzsche a lot of the time, it's finding a way out of this. How can we be positive about life, even given what Schopenhauer has told us about it? So, tiny conclusion. I think Schopenhauer's philosophy is highly idiosyncratic, often really very eccentric. And as a technical piece of metaphysics, it can be seen as deeply flawed. But what I've tried to argue is that historically it played a vital role in the transition from the 18th to the 20th century, if you like. A vital role in destabilizing general trust in religion, in progress, in rationality, indeed the trust in consciousness, confidence that humans are radically different from the animal world, and the very idea that our existence must have a meaning. All of those, I think, ideas that became really very familiar and influential in the 20th century, I think can be traced back, in part at least, to Schopenhauer. So I think reading him today, we still find very profound questions about the human condition captured with inimitable style. Thank you.